From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The writer John Cheever used to insist that his novels and short stories weren't crypto-autobiography, but much about the late writer's private life is revealed in a collection of his letters edited by his son Ben. On this edition of Fresh Air, Ben Cheever tells us that for him, the most difficult revelation was the extent of his father's homosexuality. Also today, Dutch-born conductor Ado de Waart discusses the joys and frustrations of conducting American orchestras. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, a British band from the late 50s and early 60s. And in honor of the Oscar Awards ceremony, we present a special radio adaptation of one of the movies nominated for Best Picture. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and short story writer John Cheever used to say that he wrote to make sense of his life. His daughter Susan took that to heart, and after her father died in 1982, to better understand him, she wrote a book about his life. After completing it, she thought she knew him better than she ever did while he was alive. Now Cheever's son, Ben, has edited a collection of John Cheever's letters, and Ben thanks his sister Susan for first urging him to do it. In the process, Ben also learned about his father. The collection includes John Cheever's letters to and about such literary figures as John Updike, Malcolm Cowley, Robert Penn Warren, Saul Bellow, and Philip Roth. There are also some very personal letters written to his wife and to the women and men who were his lovers. And for Ben, the most difficult revelation that came out of these letters was the extent of his father's homosexuality. Ben Cheever discusses this in his introduction to the book. I asked Ben Cheever if he published his father's letters to help him understand his relationship to his father, or if he had a more literary motivation to make his father's personal writing available to his public.
I did it really out of personal need. I did it because I wanted to keep him alive, and I wanted to understand him better. But really, I think to keep him alive, and I meant to keep him alive for other people. But when I was done with the book, and I'd handed in a manuscript, and was really pretty much done with what I had to do, I was walking through a town out in the country, holding my little son in my arms, and the fire alarm went off, and I thought it was the bomb alarm. I thought it was the end of the world. And my first thought, being very self-centered, is, oh, the book will never be published. And my second thought was, well, it doesn't really matter, because what I had to do in putting this book together, I've already done. And if people like to read it, terrific. If they don't read it, it's still done. And that's what's important. Because the book was, it was a way for me to come to terms with him. I'd say to come to terms with his death, only I don't like the idea that he died, and would just soon not acknowledge that if I can help it.
You know, a lot of writers that I know hate writing letters because it feels too much like work, you know, and they worry about every word being the right word in their letter as much as they would in their novels. And I guess I was almost surprised that John Cheever wrote so many letters.
I know he loved to write letters, and I know he loved to write. And this may be unusual. I remember talking with my mother about him. We were going for a walk when I was working on the book, and I was talking about how much I admired and envied his talent. And she said, yes, Ben, but he had to write. He had to write to live, and I hope that's not true of you. And he really did. He was always doing something with his life. He was translating it, and it was absolutely essential. It was as important to him as breathing or eating or making love. And so, you know, he didn't just write his fiction. He wrote copious journals. He wrote thousands of letters. He was always writing, and he had to be. He had to be.
He once said that saving a letter is like trying to preserve a kiss. Do you think that he thought the letters that he sent to people would be saved and eventually collected?
No, he didn't. I think he thought, and I think he counted on the fact that they would be forgotten, and I'm glad that he did, because that gives the letters a lightness, a spontaneity that I think letters often don't have. He didn't keep carbons. He didn't keep the letters people wrote to him, by and large. I mean, once in a while a letter would be important, he'd keep it, but most of the time he didn't. So there was just the feeling that this was a kiss, this was an embrace, and he could say whatever he wanted and it would be forgotten. And I'm happy for that, because it makes the book, I think, work. It makes you surprise him. You know, you almost surprise him in his letters when you read them. Go ahead.
Some of the letters are very personal. Did you go through a period of wondering whether your father would want these letters made public?
Well, I went through a period of experiencing some of these personal letters that was difficult in and of itself. It's not easy for a son to read his father's love letters to other men. But I didn't have any question in my mind that he was committed, and I think there's a lot of confusion about this, he was committed to complete exposure. Now, when he was alive, he lived a fairly private life, or for much of his life, but that was because he was producing his fiction, and he wanted his fiction to be the thing that people were most interested in. However, towards the end of his life, he was talking a lot about his journals being published, and he talked with me about it, and he said he thought it would be a good idea, and he said his only fear was that it would be upsetting for us, his children, and his wife, if she survived him. So I think people don't understand. They read the fiction and they don't understand that he had already made a willing and complete sacrifice of his privacy long before these letters or his journals were published. The most important thing for him was telling a story and was illuminating his understanding of life. And that was more important to him than any personal consideration. And so what I felt like I was doing in putting this book together was continuing that in a way that he couldn't anymore, because I don't know if he's dead, but he can't write fiction anymore. Wherever he is, the manuscripts aren't coming out. So the only thing we had that we could publish were his letters and his journals, and I knew he would have wanted it. He really would have.
Since putting this book of letters together was in part a way for you to understand your father better, I'd like for you to read one of the letters that he wrote that was about father-son relationships. And this is a letter that he wrote to a man who was a lover of his, and the man remains anonymous.
All right. Dear blank, comma, I'm truly sorry to hear about your father, and I'm much too old to have anything fresh or useful to say. I felt that I must strike some peace with my own father, although we both tried to kill one another. I made him into Leander and struck a useful peace after his death. I think you must do something of the sort. You must try to understand the man. I've told my own sons that when they find me lacking, they can continue to love me and find other men who will wear underwear, pitch no-hitters, and invent the telephone. It seems to work. I think I've known no man who has not accomplished this.
Did he, by the way, directly or indirectly, make that clear to you, that when you found him lacking, to continue to love him and look for the traits that you were missing in other men?
Well, he did say that he had had many fathers and that I should try and have many fathers too. Interestingly enough, my relationship with him was sufficiently intense that I rarely had an older mentor, and I'm only beginning to make good friends with older men now that he's gone.
Were you afraid when you were going through the letters that your father wrote that you'd find information about how he felt about you, information that might surprise or disturb you? And did anything like that happen?
Well, I was afraid. It wasn't as clear as that. But yes, I think I was afraid that I would have to come to grips with things that would make me uncomfortable. And certainly I did. Part of the good news of my father's life is that he loved a lot of people. He loved a lot of people passionately. He loved a number of women, and he loved a number of men. This is good news, because he was also lonely sometimes, and I'm pleased to know that he loved all these people. At the same time, I'm not so big that I'm not a little jealous and a little hurt by the letters that he wrote to young men he loved. He was often very loving to me, but he was very—he was passionately in love with some of these guys.
You know, in trying to think about, because I know that you say that the most disturbing revelation about the letters for you was the extent of his homosexuality, and it never occurred to me. But I see that now. That one of the things that would have disturbed you was a sense of jealousy that He had lovers who were probably around your age.
Well, that's right, and it's odd. I certainly wouldn't have wanted him to consummate his relationship with me in the way that he consummated his relationship with some of these other men. At the same time, it raises serious questions. I've been told by some of the men he was in love with that he would talk about me sometimes as someone who was physically attractive to him. I was completely unaware of this when it was going on because he was very stern in his public denial of bisexuality throughout most of his life. But it raises some interesting I wonder, because a lot of the time, the way when he was angry at me, some of the time he was angry at me because I was a pest. I think all children are, having children of my own. But some of the time he was angry at me because he loved me. And I was just reading his journals, and there's an incident in which I went to pick blueberries. I guess I was 11 years old. And I don't even remember the friend I went to pick blueberries with. It wasn't someone I particularly liked. And I come back from picking blueberries, and he's sore at me because I haven't picked a lot of blueberries. Well, I didn't know why he was angry at me. Well, it turns out he was angry at me because he thought I was off in the woods with this other kid doing something unspeakable. Well, I wasn't, you know. I don't know what we did. We just didn't find a lot of blueberries. So that's very confusing for me. When I play back my life, where was he, you know, what was love and what was hate? What was genuine disappointment, and what was his projection of his own problems on me? It's hard to figure out. I'm sure it's hard for any son to figure out.
Were you jealous that attention he was paying to other lovers was attention that he could have been paying to members of his family?
Well, one of his lovers, who I talked with, and some of them, a couple of them have been very friendly and are friends, said that to me. He said, I felt that I was taking love from your father that maybe you or your sister or your mother could have had. And I really feel, and I say in the introduction, that you have to take the people you love pretty much the way you find them. You can't say, gee, he wouldn't have been wonderful if he'd never had a drink. Wouldn't have been wonderful if he'd never loved another man or another woman. Well, he wouldn't have been himself. And love it's not like marbles. You have three of them and you give one to you give one to someone and then you don't have one to give to someone else. It's a mysterious thing, and I think probably his love, the love that he had from these people enriched his life, and the joy he got from it probably enriched mine. But I don't mean to say that having come to this understanding that I'm not capable of petty jealousies, and because I am. But I think when you really examine it, as I had to, you realize that any dramatic change in him would have also changed the man I loved in ways that might not have been fortunate.
Let me ask you to read one of the letters that he wrote to a lover. And we should say here that we've just edited the letter a little bit. We've changed a little bit of the language for broadcast.
All right, this was written from Yaddo, which is a writer's colony where he often went and stayed. Dear Blank, I will call you tonight or tomorrow and ask you to return for the weekend, and when you refuse, as I think you will, I will understand. This seems to be very much a part of my love for you. It all seems quite simple. Neither of us is homosexual, and yet neither of us are foolish enough to worry about the matter. If I want you, I know I have only to ask, and yet I know there is so much better for you in life than my love that I can think of parting from you without pain. This, of course, drives me up the wall. What I want is that which is courageous, intelligent, and truthful for us both. One cannot work out a system of true and false in the space of one's life, but I can find nothing false in my love for you. Of course, it didn't matter that you didn't have an orgasm. It wouldn't have mattered had you come 7 times. It's terribly simple. I love you, and I love to be near you. It is late in the afternoon, and I will go skiing before the light goes. Good night, my love. And I would say, if we were in bed together, and lumped or unlumped, it would be for me a very good night. Love, John.
Let me ask you about one of the lines in that letter. He says, neither of us is homosexual, It seems to me from what you've written about your father and from his letters that even though he had a lot of homosexual relationships, he just really couldn't think of himself as being homosexual at all, that somehow the word and everything it implied meant negative things to him.
Well, certainly he didn't think of himself as homosexual. And I think I have to respect that. That's why I always fumble and come up with the word bisexual. I think homosexual meant stereotypic evil things to him. And so he never labeled himself as that. He used the word in writing and in conversation, but he never really applied it to himself. And that's okay with me. I don't want to force the issue. He certainly had carnal relationships with men, but he also had carnal relationships with women right through his life.
Was he afraid that you were going to be homosexual? Because you make it seem like that was indeed one of his biggest fears.
No question he was afraid that I and my brother would be homosexual. And I think that was a real and an important fear for him. And I think that explains to some extent why he seemed so homophobic. I think he wanted to protect us from what had sometimes been a painful part of his life.
You write about how candid he was with his children and that if he had adultery, he'd not only tell you about it, but you'd find out the shade of lipstick the woman he slept with was wearing. How candid was he with you about his homosexual relationships?
Well, he wasn't candid with me about his homosexual relationships, and in fact, he was so uncandid about it that I didn't suspect it until toward the end of his life. On the other hand, he made a point of telling me before he died that he had had men as lovers, and I think that was hard for him to do. I think it was painful, and I think it was courageous.
Did your mother know?
Well, the whole question of how much a person knows and how they know it is a difficult one. So on some level, she must have known. She told me recently that she said, I must have known because when he talked on the telephone, he was always rubbing his behind with his other hand. Now, why that should mean he was bisexual, I don't know. But it meant something to her. And she also knew that he was infatuated with men, because he often was, although she didn't know that infatuation sometimes led to physical relationships.
My guest is Ben Cheever, who has just edited a collection of letters written by his father, John Cheever, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and short story writer. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
A very nice introduction to this collection of letters, and I don't know much about you. Are you a professional writer? I really have no idea how you make your living.
Well, I've always wanted to be a writer. I think everyone in his circle wanted to be a writer because he made it such a stunning, courageous thing. But I've been a writer/editor all of my professional life, and I've always written. But I don't think of the introduction to this book as writing in the way that I have thought I wanted to be a writer. This book, the parts I wrote in this book were just what I thought I absolutely had to say. I'm glad you liked it. But it was just a matter of telling my idea of what I understood what the truth was in this situation.
Would you read the very beginning of your introduction?
Yes, I'd be happy to. The introduction is titled The Man I Thought I Knew, and it begins. When my father stopped breathing, I tried to start his lungs again by blowing air through his lips. Then I put my arms around him. My mother and sister joined in the embrace. I could hear my sister and my mother crying, and then I could hear myself. We were standing at the end of the bed when the man from the funeral home arrived. All three faces were wet with tears. My father was naked except for a fresh white cast on one leg. He had taken a bad fall earlier in the week. His skin was pale and luminous like parchment, and I remember thinking that it looked as if it still had many years of wear in it.
I was wondering if it was very hard for you to write that, in the sense that I think when you're the son of a famous writer, that it's easy to feel in the shadow of your father, at least for a while, and to wonder, what would they think if they read this? And here you were actually describing the moment of his death. Was that hard to do?
Well, interestingly enough, this book wasn't hard in that way, because he wasn't here to write it, you know. If he'd been here to write his description, that would have been fine, and I wouldn't have tried. And I tried because he wasn't here. And I mean, the part I like best in the introduction is a little bit later on in the first page. The Undertaker comes, and the Undertaker is as I guess they usually are, he's rough with the body, you know, with his sacred body. And as he got ready to put it in his station wagon, I said, be careful with him or he'll bite you. And he turned to me and said, don't worry about me, I handled Rockefeller. And I said, but Rockefeller was dead. And I really felt in working on this book, and I still feel very strongly, that my father is not dead in the sense that I had always understood death before that afternoon. It may be that nobody dies in the way that, I know I sound like a crank spiritualist, but it may be. I don't burn candles and I don't. But there were periods of time in my life when I didn't get along with him. There was a period of about 7 years when we only spoke in curt telegraphic sentences. And in many ways, he was gone from me more than he is now. It's changed for him. That's the hard part. It hasn't changed for me as much as it's changed for him. He can't write anymore. If he was alive, we'd be finding manuscripts somewhere. But I do think, you know, I run a lot, and I'll come around a bend in a park, and I really, honestly, will expect to see him there.
In your introduction, in your preface, in your acknowledgments, you mentioned that your wife is going to learn something reading this, and that is that in one of your rages while writing the book, you actually broke the leg of the old wooden rocking chair and you glued it back together without telling her about any of this. And it made me wonder, what were those rages about when you were writing this book?
Well, I'm not sure what they were about. I think that, there was something that I was trying to consummate, and I'm still not sure whether I have or not. I'm trying to deal with what's happened to Daddy, and I'm trying to deal with the things that I'm trying to deal with missing him. I don't know how to explain it. When I would go, I would work on these letters for a couple of hours, and just sitting alone, I would type them into a computer, reading them, typing them. I would feel like he was around, because he's really there in the letters. You can smell him, you can taste him. I think even if you don't know him, certainly if you did. And then I'd get done, and I'd cry. First I thought, well, it's just because I miss him so much. And then the other day, my wife was writing something and wanted me to read her a line from a Houseman poem. So I looked up, it was To an Athlete Dying Young, I looked up the Houseman poem and read it to myself before I called her and read it to her. And I cried then, too. So maybe it's just a beauty. But yes, it was still is a very painful thing for me to do. It is my hope that this book will be useful for other people who want to do whatever they're doing, come to terms with their lives and their fathers. It's also my hope that finally it will have been useful to me. But hard, yes, it's the hardest thing I've ever done. I'm middle class, so I don't know hardship in the way that many people in the world do. I've run a lot of marathons. I've certainly had lots of failures in my life. I've had a divorce. And nothing's been anything like as hard as this. And I'm not sure why. Maybe I didn't know that there was such a thing as death, and I had to deal with that. And maybe it has to do with the fact that that I thought my father was the rock bed of my understanding of the world, because he was so candid and because he told such gorgeous stories, not just when he was writing but when he was talking. And to have found that there was so much that I didn't know, didn't understand about him, has kind of shaken my faith. I hope to establish a new and more secure faith as the result of this work. I'm not sure I have yet.
In your acknowledgments, you thank Adam Bellow, who's the son of Saul Bellow, the writer, and you thank him for helping you realize what being the son of a famous writer does and doesn't mean. What have you realized it doesn't mean?
Well, Adam's been a wonderful friend, and all friendships are helpful, but one of the things that I realize is that many of the things that got between me and Daddy weren't of his making or of mine, and had to do with the fact that he was perceived a certain way by the world, and that the world necessarily perceives me a certain way because of it. And it's important to know that that doesn't have to do with him. Saul Bellow and my father enjoyed each other's company and admired each other as writers, but they're very different people. So if Adam and I both have the same cross, the cross must have been given to us not by our fathers, but by the world. Just a little example of the kind of thing that can happen is that I went to a liquor store this summer and signed a check for some bottles of wine, and the girl behind the counter, who'd been pleasant with me up until then, said, you aren't any relation to the writer John Cheever, are you? And I said, yes, I'm his son. And she said, oh, this is almost a great experience, she said. This is a secondhand great experience. So there is a tendency on the part of people to look at me, see me for a second, and then see him. And I love him very much, loved him very much. We were often quite close, but we are not identical. And that's troubling and even painful. And I think Adam has had that too. And so it was a joy for me to know that a lot of this trouble didn't have to do with him, just had to do with the fact that the world looks at me. They think of me, I think, automatically as, you raised an apt question, they think of me automatically as a kind of second-rate John Cheever. And I think to some extent every son is an imitation of a father, but I'm really not a second-rate John Cheever. I'm Ben Cheever. I may be a second-rate Ben Cheever, but I'm not, you know, we're different, that's all.
Well, Ben Cheever, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Ben Cheever edited a collection of letters written by his father. The Letters of John Cheever is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with journalist James Fallows. For the past 3 years, he's reported from Asia for the Atlantic Monthly and National Public Radio. In his new book, More Like Us, Fallows looks at the uniqueness of the United States by contrasting it with Japan and other Asian societies. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Since Ato DeVart took over the directorship of the Minnesota Orchestra, he's had to deal with more than just music. There were the musicians who were used to the previous music director, Neville Mariner, and the people in the business office who argued that playing more experimental works would hurt ticket sales. Coming up, Ato DeVart talks about the frustrations and the pleasures of running an orchestra. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, a band from England that predated the British invasion of the 60s. Their hits influenced younger British rockers. And as everyone gets ready for Oscar night, we present a radio adaptation of one of the films up for Best Picture. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. President Bush wants to know exactly what's being done to clean up the nation's worst oil spill, and he sent three top federal officials to Alaska to find out. Mr. Bush says he would consider having the government take over cleanup efforts, which the Exxon company today admitted were not going well. The oil slick covers over 100 square miles of Prince William Sound off Alaska. The National Transportation Safety Board has scheduled hearings on the accident for next week. Officials say reports that the captain of the tanker Exxon Valdez has a history of drunken driving convictions are one area of concern. Negotiations to end a three-day-old prison takeover continue today in Guatemala City. The country's president has reiterated his intention that the uprising end peacefully. Reports indicate at least 60 people have been killed or wounded in the takeover, and prisoners are holding some 600 hostages. Susan Loeffler has the latest.
Talks center on inmates' demands that they be given amnesty or have their sentences reduced, that the prison director be fired, and that living conditions be improved. Last night, the government agreed not to punish the rioters and to try to reduce their sentences. Today, President Vinicio Cerezo's office issued its first official statement on the takeover. The communique stressed the need for dialogue, saying the lives of innocent people were at risk. The prison, about 12 miles outside of Guatemala City, is quiet today. 1,500 troops stationed at the facility yesterday are now out of the public view. Negotiations, which are being conducted through an intermediary, are continuing. For National Public Radio, I'm Susan Loeffler in Guatemala City.
A Soviet foreign ministry spokesman hinted today that regional communist leaders who were defeated in Sunday's general election could be stripped of their party posts. Gennady Gerasimov said the officials will need to explain their defeat to the party. Sunday's historic vote was the first contested election in the Soviet Union in 70 years. Moscow's newspapers have made no comment on the results, but the defeat of party leaders appears certain to alarm the Kremlin. The death count from 6 days of ethnic unrest in Yugoslavia's Kosovo province stands at 21 today. Two of the dead are policemen. The violence has many observers beginning to count the cost both at home and abroad. Pierre Vickery reports.
The riot police, many in full battle gear, are out on patrol. Armored cars can be seen on street corners, and the curfew has kept most people at home. But after 5 days of the most violent demonstrations in 45 years of communist rule, no one is predicting an end to the uprising. The Serbs in Belgrade are celebrating their victory, and the Albanians in Kosovo what they see as a sellout. It was their own leaders who voted to accept the changes, which now mean that Serbs, not Albanians, will run the province. The chants in the street have been angry and militant. Bring back the 1974 constitution and praise for the man who made that possible, late President Tito. The irony is that the Yugoslav Communist Party, which came to power as a result of a guerrilla war led by Tito, is now busy pulling apart the society he built. The National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery reporting.
The Air Force today grounded its fleet of 97 B-1B bombers. The B-1Bs were grounded after one of the planes sustained a punctured fuel tank during a pre-flight check. It's just the latest in a series of problems that have plagued the fleet of B-1B bombers, each of which cost $280 million. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 17.5 points to close at 2275.36. Advances outpaced declines on volume of 113 million shares. Average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 12 cents. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the late 50s and early 60s, the British rocker Johnny Kidd looked rougher and sang tougher than the average teen idol in his country. And rock and roll historian Ed Ward says Kidd got played on the BBC only because he sold so many records. Ed has this profile of Johnny Kidd and his band. It takes a whole
Do you know what an oxymoron is? It's a word for a contradiction in terms, a tall dwarf or a serious joke, or, in the 50s, a British rock and roller. It's not that the British didn't try. One pretty boy after another came out of the traditional British star-making process. But the record-buying public had been spoiled by imported Elvis Presley records and the occasional tour by somebody like Buddy Holly, Eddie Cochran, or Gene Vincent. They knew the genuine item when they heard it, and non-entities like Jimmy Quickly weren't it. Frederick Heath, however, was. In 1959, he was a 20-year-old with a fixation on American rhythm and blues records that preceded Mick Jagger's and Brian Jones's obsessions by half a decade. He had a band, he had ambition, and, at last, he had a record contract.
Well, I just ain't got a word to say. Please don't touch. I shake so much. Please don't touch. I shake so much.
Please Don't Touch sounds pretty tame today, but it was a rude shock when it came out, and the people who didn't buy it fell into two categories. The ones who were offended by its crudity, and the ones who felt that none of their countrymen could really rock. It went into the top 30 for several weeks, though, and using the name Johnny Kidd, Heath started touring. A month or so later, something very odd happened. During a show, a guitar string snapped and lodged in his eye. Kidd played the rest of his set with blood streaming down his face, dashed backstage and wrapped a black kerchief across his eye, and went back to play the encore. His fans went wild and told him that he looked like Captain Kidd, and from that day on, he wore an eye patch, and the act was Johnny Kidd and the Pirates. Trouble was, he had a hard time coming up with another hit.
You don't know how restless you've made me.
Songs like Restless show that he was a so-so vocalist fronting a decent band, and his attempts at covering American rhythm and blues records were even worse. But in 1960, he got that magic moment.
Helped along by Mick Green's infectious guitar work, Shaken All Over became a top hit in England. It wasn't picked up anywhere else until the Guess Who had a hit with it here in 1965. But it inspired lots of young Britons like Pete Townsend and Jimmy Page, who thought that this, at last, was a rocker they could love. But Johnny Kidd missed out on the British invasion, and although he was much in demand for live shows, he never had another hit. In October 1966, he was killed in a head-on collision on a remote country road in Lancashire, his recording career long over. Still, that's not the end of the story. In 1977, as punk was exploding over England and the pub rock return to simplicity movement was absorbing older British fans, a name kept cropping up in the press whenever a guitarist was interviewed, Mick Green of Johnny Kidd's Pirates. Where were they now? Sitting around, itching to play again, as it turned out. It was the original three, Green, bassist vocalist Johnny Spence, and drummer Frank Farley. And on this 1977 record, you can hear Mick Green's groundbreaking guitar style, in which he plays lead and rhythm guitar simultaneously. The trio found that times had caught up with them, so they made a couple of records for Warner Brothers, toured and made a bunch of money, and went into semi-retirement, playing now when the spirit moves them. Not only does their story point out that great rock and roll is timeless, but it also has a mostly happy ending.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. That's the opening of The Chairman Dances by John Adams, recorded by the San Francisco Symphony, conducted by Ado de Waart. The Dutch-born conductor earned a reputation as a 20th century music specialist when he conducted the San Francisco Symphony from 1977 to 1985. Currently, de Waart is music director of the Minnesota Orchestra. He divides his time between Minneapolis and Amsterdam, where he's artistic director of the Dutch Radio Orchestra. As a music student in Amsterdam, de Waart studied oboe, but found conducting better suited his personality.
I have always liked the total involvement. There must be a bossy side to me that it is nicer to tell people what to do than being told what to do. I'm sure that has something to do with it. I was always giving my opinions about everything, asked or unasked. And I think as a conductor, you have to have some of that. Although in personal life, that can be a real drag for the people around you. You just need to be able to have strong opinions and being willing to stand for them and get them knocked and still fight for them, which was one of the reasons why my conducting teacher took me. He said, yeah, it will be good for your character. You will finally understand how hard it is to conduct, since you have always so much criticism.
Was there one experience that really showed you how hard it was going to be?
I think once I started getting mixed reviews, you know, you go do a concert 1 week and they would say that is terrific, and the next week they would say this was no good at all. That was hard to take, to the public bashing that you get, and that took me many years to even get used to, and maybe one never gets totally used to being judged in public all the time, especially by people that you not always have a lot of respect for.
Mm-hmm.
And the personal one has to learn in life, if you're not gifted with a great deal of personal charm. And you know, I've always been a very direct person who said what he felt, and that coming from a 25-year-old whippersnapper to older musicians is not going to make life easy for you. And
yeah.
I must say, I ran into quite a lot of bad stuff in the beginning. You know, misunderstandings, things that I said and I didn't mean to say. So I had to, several times in Rotterdam, my first orchestra, which I went to when I was, I think, how old was I, 26 or so, there have been 4 or 5 occasions where I apologized to the orchestra, not pressed by them, thank God, out of my own feeling that I had gone too far.
After establishing yourself in the Netherlands, you came fairly regularly to America to conduct. In 1975, you became principal guest conductor of the San Francisco Orchestra. Then you took over the orchestra in 1977. And I'm wondering what it was like to adjust to conducting in America. Did you find that the conductor was expected to have a different relationship to the players than what you were used to in the Netherlands?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good point, because it has a lot to do with the way American orchestras are run, which to this day I have sometimes a hard time dealing with. And what I mean is that I come really out of a culture where the orchestra itself is a very strong, sometimes runs itself basically, or at least is very heavily heard in every big decision. They have representation on the board. The board is only 5 to 7 or maybe 9 people at the most, not these 60, 70, 80 people boards that you have in America, and where the orchestra and management are actually seen as two totally contrary bodies that fire salvos over the continental divide. You know, it's just, it was different. And I must say, even though I've learned to deal with it, it is not natural for me to be that far removed in many ways from what actually make all of us be there, and that is the orchestra.
I think there's a lot of competition between orchestras in the United States. You know, who's going to get the big recording contract? Who's going to get the PBS series or the NPR series? Was there the same kind of competition in the Netherlands, or do you think that the States is more competitive between orchestras?
Oh, I think it is more competitive because the stakes are bigger. When you're all subsidized, you don't get this cutting edge of trying to sneak things away from under each other's noses. While here, where you really have to rely on selling tickets, this whole image thing, how are we perceived, how good are we? Are we perceived as being as good as we really are, and is our marketing doing well? You have to be much sharper, and you know, it brings non-artistic things to bear. I think a big danger threatening the whole American art scene, but particularly symphony orchestras, is that marketing departments, if we don't watch out, will dictate what we will play, and the programming will be dictated by how many people will we get into the hall, which will be tremendously impoverishing, because we know that if you play Beethoven 5 and 1812 and all that sort of stuff, you will have full halls, and if you play Sessions and Carter and other people, you will have 500-600 people there. And the more people you get, the more you will get unsophisticated people that had not normally thought of coming into the concert hall. And so in some ways we get them in. They are not the people that will take kindly to even Bartok and Stravinsky, let alone Schoenberg and Webern. And so in order to get them in, you will also have to do away with your adventurous programming.
I think audiences bring a lot of preconceptions and expectations to orchestral performances. Are there changes that you could make if you could basically redesign our conception of an orchestra from scratch?
I think we have become too much institutionalized. We have become too little adventurous, and we have become too much set in ways that maybe are not all that good for the music. What are we doing? Why are we doing this? Why are we playing Beethoven? What did it mean at that time when Beethoven's Fifth first rolled through that hall? People must have jolted in their seats. We don't have that surprise anymore. So we must in the way we play it, we must try and think back how it was. This might mean that we behave ourselves a little different, that it is, maybe it wasn't so bad that Toscanini sometimes yelled. Maybe we only have to get used to that orchestra musicians will yell back, and that that necessarily is not all that bad.
For years, you were thought of as one of the new, young, rising conductors to watch out for. And now you're approaching middle age. And I was wondering if you approach your scores differently than you did when you were younger.
I think I have seen myself gone through two phases very much. At the very beginning, this wonderment and this wonderful adventure trip through a country and through places that I'd never seen before that I just knew existed. However, I did them with a breakneck speed and very seldom got a chance to really look at the pieces because I did so many of them. It's like some American tourist doing Europe in 6 days and and saying, oh, I've seen Florence and Rome and all these cities. And, well, they saw the airports. And I think I sometimes felt that I only saw the airports. And then there came a phase where I was got the responsibility for first the Rotterdam Philharmonic and then San Francisco, and felt I've always been someone who is very interested in the intricacies of playing, of the fundamentals of music making, not just seeing making music as a state of mind, but as a craft. And I became very much obsessed with that, and the music suffered in many ways. I think these last couple of years, more and more, there is happening some sort of an amalgamation of everything. Everything is... I am now in the happy circumstance that I am music director of a very good orchestra, which can play terrific technically and musically. And I also seem to be more able to both in rehearsal work on the technical side and the musical side. And in many ways, this is almost the most exciting time that I've had as a music director, and I hope it will last.
Ida DeVart is music director of the Minnesota Orchestra. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us from Washington, D.C. to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, are you doing an analysis of yesterday's elections in the Soviet Union?
Yeah, we'll be hearing again from Ann Cooper in Moscow, and also a report from New York, actually, about Ukrainian nationalism. The Ukraine was one of the places, among many, where opponents of party leaders were defeated in races for this new Soviet legislature. We'll also be hearing about the news from Iran that the Ayatollah Montazeri, who had been designated as the successor to Ayatollah Khomeini, has stepped out of the line of succession, and we'll hear what that means. It may, in fact, clear the way for Rafsanjani, the speaker of the Majlis, the Iranian parliament, to be the next leader of the country.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In Hollywood, the glitterati are getting ready for the big Oscar night. We have a special radio tribute to one of the contenders.
Good evening. This is Basil Starling.
Basil Starling, genius of the American theater.
Super genius.
A super genius of the American theater presents a salute to the Academy Awards. Tonight, Dangerous Liaisons, based on the novel based on a novel. Good evening, everybody. I'm Carlton Carlton, and I bring you exciting news indeed, because tonight, Lady Lavinia, that's Lady Lavinia. Lady Lavinia welcomes the great hope of the American stage as the director and star of Dangerous Liaisons. He writes his own scripts, directs them, and makes them live and breathe with the warmth of his genius.
Super genius.
His super genius. Ladies and gentlemen, Basil Starling.
Thank you so much, Mr. Carlton. Members of the audience, as always, I am obediently yours. Tonight I'm pleased to bring a story before you, a story whose star glimmers most brightly in the firmament of literature. Ladies and gentlemen, Dangerous Liaisons.
Ah!
An urgent message for the Vicomte de Valmont.
An urgent message? Give it to me.
Your reply, Vicomte.
Take this reply at once, and I cannot stress its urgency. To the Marquis de Montiel.
Sure. What was that name again?
You know, just as you can't adapt a full-length novel into 3.5 minutes, so too you can't rush proper dental care.
Thanks, Terry. And you know, the latest word in clean teeth is Lady Lavinia's oral sandblaster. And now back to the Basil Starling production of Dangerous Liaisons.
Why have you taken me away from the party, Viscount?
It is beyond my control.
Monsieur, you led me to believe...
It is beyond my control.
...that you loved me. Why are you walking to the window? Look at me.
It is beyond my control.
Hey, you up there, shut up! People trying to get some sleep!
This is outrageous, sir! We're recording a radio drama. I'm Basil Starling.
And I'm Jerry Gutkin.
Jerry Gutkin, the musical comedy star?
Why, yes.
Well, maybe you'd like to join me in a little song.
Roll out those dangerous liaisons. Yes, it's a movie that's created quite a stir. Oh, we would certainly enjoy all those liaisons if we only knew what liaisons were.
First there was Malkovich and he was scoping Glenn close. She didn't dig him, he wasn't pain man.
But by that time we were back out in the lobby
to see if maybe we could sneak in to see Rain Man.
Mr. Starling, I'm sorry, we seem to be running out of time.
Well, Terry, what did you think of my acting?
It's a once-in-a-lifetime performance.
Really?
That's why you won't be on next week.
You've been listening to an adaptation of Dangerous Liaisons, written, produced, and directed by Basil Starling, genius of the American...
A super genius
of the American stage. Next week, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Basil Starling's production of Dangerous Liaisons was actually written and performed by Robert Kaplow and the Punsters and produced by Tim Corzin. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. When TV's Maud debated having an abortion, religious advocacy groups besieged the network. But a decade later, when an episode of Cagney and Lacey tackled the abortion issue, the producer played up the controversy to attract a larger audience. On the next Fresh Air, media analyst Catherine Montgomery explains how pressure groups try to influence TV's content and how the networks react. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album by the British choral group The Tallis Scholars. And book critic John Leonard reviews Our Kind of People, the new family memoir from Pulitzer Prize-winning book critic and columnist Jonathan Yardley. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Salad. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton, who also directed today's show. Research assistance from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.